of two eyes. Huh? Do you understand the game a bit? Yeah, have a look.
I'm not saying anything to you in particular because I know you're not too accurate with your reporting.
That's what you paid for.
So you're saying I should resign? So you're saying I should resign?
I think
that's your opinion.
Yeah.
Is that right?
That's my opinion.
Okay, fine.
Are you going to resign then?
No, of course I'm not going to resign.
I simplify things next time.
Hello and welcome to a belated special Monday edition of the National Curriculum on ESPN. I'm Josh Parrish. I've got Joey Lynch, Taryn Heddo, and Nick Stoll here with me. Good evening, guys.
Sorry about playing the wrong intro.
Yeah, you had one job, Nick Stoll. One. Just before we get started, just Josh. So, how do I do this, Josh? Is it just, you know, just.
Oh, it's funny. That, it's funny you say that, Joey, because.
Starts with a visual gag on a podcast. Come on, Joey.
Whoa.
You actually did it. Disgusting. Yeah. Disgusting. Oh, that's gross. For those listening, well, to be honest, just skip this part because it's just going to be Joey spitting for the next 5 minutes. He just took a bite out of some soap.
I really wish we just discussed these intro gags earlier because you've rather stolen my thunder here, Joey. I just have something to attend to right here. Just before we get the show underway, I've just got some oral hygiene issues that I have to deal with. So if you just bear with me as I go through the motions.
See, you've got no commitment. Yours is actually supposed to go in your mouth.
Feeling fresh. You got to keep it fresh on the podcast. And that's exactly what we're doing today.
This is so far. This is by far the grossest intro that we've ever had to this show. And that includes the multiple times I've had my shirts off and the multiple times that people have been eating on microphones. What a way to welcome our guest, Taryn.
And
I'm
the
sorry.
Multiple times that Ante used to clear his throat into the microphone.
Oh, yeah. When he was sick. Gee, I don't know how those aliens are still dealing with Ante and his grossness. You know what? Can you imagine Ante actually on the UFO? He would be criticizing the aliens for how they've set up their thing. He'd be like, you guys don't even know how to do an invasion, right? Of Earth. This is a terrible invasion. You got me, one guy, embarrassing stuff.
Imagine Ante being the example of the human race for foreign life forms to be studied.
That's why they gave up. They gave up. They got to him and they were like, oh, if they're all like this, don't want them. All good. We'll go to the next planet. No worries.
Taryn, we've got you on this week. What an introduction for you. I'm sure you're already regretting your decision to come on the podcast, but
I'm shocked by the commitment to the bit. I just, you know, it's one thing to get the soap out and to, you know, pretend like you're going to take a bite, you know, but that was full on commitment.
Josh, that can is, you just explain what all these references are for just the few people that didn't see what went down on Twitter yesterday?
Well, the Venn diagram of people who saw that tweet and who are listening to this podcast is a circle, but the podcast probably circle inside a bigger circle now that I think of it. Apparently I offended Alessandro Diamanti, for which, you know, I am sorry.
He did explicitly say no one was offended, right? He kind of backtracked on he came out swinging and then he kind of like he does in matches. He kind of took a shot from distance, right? and then maybe kind of slightly regretted it.
it was funny to have like a very like visceral personal attack and then for it to be followed up with, but I only want good vibes.
Good vibes.
It's like, where do you go from there?
The best was, just to be clear, happy Sunday to everyone. That was my
which
favorite.
I appreciate. I did have a happy Sunday. So thank you, Alino. I had a very happy
that is
Sunday.
It's for you, like, thanks and success, just to be clear. Happy Sunday. I might insult you. And then the other one was like, you promote your stuff. I promote football, 25 years in the business. You can't fool me. Like, who's trying to fool you, bro? Anyway, it was, I got to say, as the president of the Make Australian Football Fun Society, the MAF Society, which you guys are all obviously board members of that society, very much like when, you know, heroes of the game are beefing with podcasts hosts. It makes for wonderful entertainment on a Sunday. So happy Sunday to everyone out there. Happy Monday, coming to a new time slot. But it's good because there's lots to talk about, including the Matildas and Warren Moon getting sacked.
Can I make some serious points about the video I put out, by the way?
Yeah.
Right. Just to sort of address it. So, look, this is going to sound like very highfalutin and stupid, but if you know about like essay structure, you have thesis, you have antithesis, and then synthesis. So I used Charlie Austin. I'll just say,
my essays did not have that. They had copy paste and copy paste thesaurus to change the words.
Well, I was using Daniel Sturridge, Nani, and Charlie Austin as examples of failed high-profile marquee signings. And obviously, like, people calling it clickbait. Well, yeah, I mean, God forbid I try and get somebody to watch a video I've made. You know, that's kind of my job.
Also, it wasn't like you said, like, here are the three players that you'll never guess who have flopped in the A-League.
What sort of stellar are you going to do? The winds of change are rolling through A-League's strategies.
Like, it wasn't... I'm very impressed because I didn't have him in the title or anything. So he watched the entire video and then must have suddenly been blindsided by at the end. It got really mad. Because
he's watching it going, yeah, these guys suck. I'm so much better than them. And then he's like, hey, what the fuck?
Me? I was bringing up Diamante as actually a counter example of someone as assigning a high-profile marquee signing that's been successful. Now, there were a few lines that got cut for time to get it down to that 2:20 or whatever. But I meant for it to sound as if, oh, actually, here's an example of a signing, you know, that of a high-profile foreign marquee that's been, you know, unquestioned success. As I said, he was a Johnny Warren medal winner. He had two of the highest output seasons in terms of chance creation. But
I think when he re-signed, he was actually inside the cap.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's not a lot of clear information on who is and isn't inside the cap. Those things aren't really reported very clearly. So it was actually quite hard to cobble together that list. But then I brought up the stats, which I had to hand. And I've got to, you know, we get stats from Opta. And then I've got to draw conclusions from the statistics, not start with something and then set out to prove it, you know, by cherry-picking statistics. And if you look at his four seasons, including the current one, his first two seasons were much more productive than his second two seasons. And that's all I was trying to get across. And obviously, like, he had a huge knee injury for most of that. So it's amazing on Twitter because you never quite know the things you put out. You don't know whether they're going to be, like, so controversial.
Yeah,
like there are tweets, like hot takes that I've put out on Twitter that I thought I was going to get a lot of blowback on. Mm-hmm. And I either got people agreeing with me or ignoring it. But it's so weird to me that this is the one that inspired the, you know, the wave of blowback that it got. So, you know, it's a statistics video. I didn't make up the numbers. You know, I didn't just pull them out of thin air because I have a personal vendetta. And I was trying to provide a sense of balance in the video's thesis, which is that, you know, the highest profile marquees haven't worked out, by using Diamante as a counter example of that. But you also have to take into account that this season and last season have not been as stellar in terms of output as the first two, which is natural because he's 39 years old. That's all I got to say.
Yeah. But, you know, you got to, what did he say? Get informed.
Get informed. Get informed.
Get informed. Look.
What was it? Josh, you have not offended anyone. You've got the wrong name to make this example. That's it.
Hey, look, anyway, and look, he's absolutely got the right to defend himself on Twitter.
Yes.
That's absolutely fine. But I don't take it personally. So
look, no, I'm not really taking sides in this you know, Tupac versus Big E beef that's going down. But what I will say is interesting that, like, you're right, like, you didn't tag him in it, like, he's kind of gone out and found it in what, maybe just because he really likes the work of Josh Parrish. But also, I noticed as well, there was a couple of weeks back where someone tweeted out a video of him kind of doing a warm down in the sun. It was like 35 degrees or some stupid temperature out in Western Sydney. And he was there and someone was like, why have they got Diamante running like this at the age of, you know, 39, blah, blah, blah. And eventually it came out to be a thing that was like, and he responded with, like, I'm setting an example. So, like, it's interesting that's he's really letting people know that he is no longer done at this top level, which, you know, for whatever reason.
I think it's also important to say that I wasn't making any sort of value judgment in that video. Mm. I wasn't having, like, a personal go. But his reply suggested that he thought I'd questioned, you know, his application or his intention, that he was just here, you know, to make money and have a holiday, which is... that didn't occur in the video. I was just looking at numbers, you know. And even that also applies even to Austin and Sturridge and Nani to varying degrees. Most of those guys, you know, certainly two of those guys have pretty much been sidelined by injury, and you're not questioning their application. It's not Nani's fault that he did his ACL. You know, it just happens.
And it's a little bit.
Well, maybe, but it's what I'm saying is it's a hazard of bringing players of that age profile out here into a summer league on hard pitches that you're going to end up with injuries. And so that's a massive risk with the substantial investment that these clubs are making. And it's not as if Australian football is rolling in cash.
And it's good you say hazard, because I think it's going to be really cool when we bring out Eden Hazard here in a few years' time, who John Obi Mikel described as the worst trainer he's ever come across. And let me tell you something. I already liked Eden Hazard. You know, he was a wonderful player in his prime at Chelsea. And the fact that he went to Real Madrid, cost them $100 million and absolutely flopped means I like him even more. Take that money from that club. But the other thing about it is I respect you so much if you're that talented and never trained a day in your life. Like, you know, people are like, oh, yeah, you got to respect Ronaldo for all the effort he put in. Nah, man, I respect Ronaldinho, Eden Hazard, all these players who barely show up to training and just razzle. That is my dream. That's how I want to live my life. So anyway, it's an interesting time on social media. I tweeted out a 10-second clip of KSI and Logan Paul on the stage show and 5.4 million people saw it. So don't know. If you're tuning in because you want more KSI and Logan Paul content, I'm sorry. I'm all out. That was my one and only time I'll ever really talk about those people.
What do we think of Tottenham?
Yeah, that was the best part about that clip was Karl Stefanovic going, that's fantastic. At 8:20 in the morning, he's got a guy yelling shit into a microphone on breakfast TV. 10,000, you know, 14-year-old boys are yelling shit back to him. And Karl Stefanovic, they're going, oh, that's fantastic.
Listen. We should probably start talking about the Matildas. I'm just going to sum it all up with this.
We'll dig our way out.
Now, dig up, stupid.
Simpsons, I think on Disney Plus in Australia.
Right? Yes, absolutely, which is why I'm hoping we don't get copyright struck. But let's move on.
Let's move on. This show's under 90 minutes, by the way. No, twice in a row. Oh, Ben Smith. Josh, host this show if your mouth is feeling.
Oh, what do we think of Diamante, says Ben Smith? Oh, look, I think we spent 15 minutes or so talking about that. So, Poibo, you know.
No, I think Ben Smith is making a very good reference to what KSI said.
Yeah, no, I got it. Look, I think we should talk Matildas because rather than petty Twitter squabbles, even though that seems to be what everyone's enthused about, Australia 3. Spain B 2. Taron.
Beh, I believe it's pronounced.
Well, then I would have said España. Taron, what did you make of that performance as a whole?
Yeah, we won. We beat Spain. And yes, it's Spain B. Spain B still beat the US a couple months back. So Spain B is still a pretty good side.
To be honest, it's probably Spain C. Given that 20 players at this point are saying they won't play. So that's Spain C pretty much.
I mean, if we're calling Australia B the team that went over and still had, you know, half the starting 11 of normal last year, then it's probably close to Spain C. How is C pronounced, Stoll?
Se. Yeah.
All right, Spain Se.
This sounds like a lot of algebra. B plus C plus A. Yeah. It's getting very complicated for me who copied and pasted all of my exams.
But yeah, no, either way, we won. I think obviously first half we came out, we played 4-4-2 formation. We had Kerr and Ford up top in a front two, which was glorious to see. That was just...
Do you think that's how it's going to continue now? Do you think that is the template?
I hope so. I mean, we've won six out of our last six games, and in all of those six games, that's come since the change in formation. So you would think so. I mean, it's certainly been a more successful formula, and I think that the reason for that is because it allows Sam Kerr to not just be that player up top. I think in the past, when we've gotten in situations where we've desperately needed a goal, the blueprint was, quick, kick the ball to Sam Kerr. If there is someone alongside her, regardless of who it is, although ideally it is Caitlin Ford, that allows her to drop a little bit deeper, play more of a part in build-up play. And we saw that happen in this game. We regularly saw her drop deep, win a header, release Vinyl Raso, who was then able to release someone else. So, yep, scored 3 goals in the first half. That was great. Few things changed in the second half. Instead of the high press, we decided to give them space on the ball, which I think we looked a lot less cohesive when we did that. Obviously, you can't press for 90 minutes. That's a problem to solve. But yeah, I think overall, 4-4-2 is the way to go. It's, you know, everyone makes it, oh, it's 4-4-2. It's Burnley ball. I mean, not quite. But I do think it's 4-4-2.
There's variation.
Yeah. You know, the fullbacks are running around and, you know, it's a bit more inventive.
I've seen Barca Hombres sign team play 4-4-2 in the past when they had Messi and Suarez kind of up front. So, like, you know, just because you're playing 4-4-2, it is just the allocation of, you know, players and numbers and stuff. Like, you can play 4-4-2 in a way that isn't simplistic, you know, channels, long ball, knockdown nonsense.
Yes.
So, you know, the 4-4-2 has a bad label. You know, it needs to rebrand as something else.
I mean, yeah, every format. It's format. I mean, it's why increasingly in coaching that formations in some circles of coaching are being seen as archaic and outdated. And now it's just less about having a formation versus just having players do certain roles and principles. But yeah, if we are to go back to basics, yeah, I think the 4-4-2 works well. I mean, we've discussed on this pod about how maybe it would have been good to see a 3-5-2 at points throughout the journey. But given that that is apparently not an option, I think the 4-4-2 works. And I think you mentioned there, Taryn, about, you know, maybe it's Ford, somebody else. I think it was really important. It is Ford in this circumstances, as Ben says. Maybe given that we have seen such an increase in form with this 4-4-2, maybe Ford is getting to the point where she is as important as Kerr to making this team tick. Because, I mean, we see Kerr at Chelsea where she is right up there for the best players of the world. At Chelsea, she's not asked to do everything because she has such an amazing team around her at Chelsea. Ergo, not asking her to do absolutely everything in the Matildas, counterintuitive as it may sound, might actually make her a better player with the Matildas. And because we've seen, like, you remember the times even at Perth Glory, where was she at her best? When she was able to freelance and go to the left and go to predominantly the left, or go to the right and drive the ball inside and do other things. And in a 4-4-2, when she's got somebody playing alongside her, she's unable to do that. So I really
like to say, it's the first time I've ever heard a player referred to as freelancing. It's not like looking for gigs, you know.
Oh, trust me. I know all about freelancing. No footballer ever wants to actually freelance. You're absolutely right.
But freelance footballer, though. Turning up 1 week for one team, going to another team the next week.
We've had
the same team in the same game.
We've had A-League players that have come close to racking up enough teams to be considered a freelancer. And then Ford was wasted on the wing. We saw early in the Gustafsson tenure when she was playing on the wing, she was wasted. She wasn't being used as well as she can, what she can do on the ball. She's an incredibly instinctive player and she's best deployed inside. So, heck, it's remarkable that, you know, I think Vince Rogari wrote an article about picking the best players to play in their best positions and then letting them do their thing. It's remarkable how easy this coaching thing is at times, isn't it? Like we were talking before we came on air, Taryn, about, oh, Claire Hunt, what an amazing find. Well, not really an amazing find. She's the best eligible centre-back playing in the A-League women. So you pick her and you play her at centre-back and it works. Wow. I mean, it's fantastic. So, yeah, I think it is, you know, that is why it really works. And I would concur also with Taryn about the second stanza. That is the concern for me, is about when you can't press, how do the Matildas control a game and manage a game and see games out? Because right now they sort of strike me as a buzzsaw. If you get them going, if you point them in the right direction, the right angle, they can go through anything. They can cut everything. It's when they have to come from a different angle, you worry if they're just too, if there's only one speed here, what's their second speed? What's their third speed? How do they control games? How do they slow games down? How do they control the tempo of games and dictate terms when it's not just a game of basketball on a football pitch? Is, I think, maybe the next issue that we need to look at. Things are going well. Things are going a lot better than they were six games ago, but we're talking about a team winning the World Cup. So these are the discussions we're going to have.
Yeah, I mean, I think the press conference after the Czechia game was interesting in that respect. Tony Gustafsson talking about low blocks and how it's sort of a game of patience and how proud he was for the team to kind of settle down and find a way through in that situation, which shows the, I guess, the anxieties of where, you know, these teams' weak points, you know, still are in terms of taking that more patient approach, and especially, you know, in the heightened intensity of a World Cup atmosphere when you're not necessarily, you know, going to be as clear-headed as you would be in a friendly match. But I'm still just imagining freelancing footballers. I mean, imagine just getting to the end of the season and going, oh, God, I've got to do my invoicing. Just
and you've got to do your taxes and all of that sort of stuff, because, like, nobody takes taxes out. So you've got to calculate,
Imagine you're interviewing a player and they've got to get their plugs away for who they're playing for on the weekend. Yeah, I'm playing for the Wanderers on Sunday. You can catch me at Sydney Olympic on Monday. And then on Tuesday, should have something in futsal. So go check out that. I just also wanted to point out, I don't know if you guys ever have seen the movie Traffic, where, like, the three different settings are shot with three different kind of tones. That's kind of what me and Josh look like now. Like, Josh looks like he's in the Michael Douglas Washington DC scene, and I'm in the Mexico sepia tone scene. Look, if you're listening to the pod, there's gonna make no sense to you, but just go to the 22nd minute mark, you can check that out. But Taryn, I wanted to know from you, we're going into the World Cup now. Like, I feel like 2 years ago, maybe, you know, we were kind of thinking, oh, you know, we're going to be like semi-finalists. And then we went on a bit of a bad run of games where we kind of, you know, we had those bad results against the big European nations. And it seemed like the feeling was more like, you know, we'd be lucky to get like quarterfinals, second round. Now we've got the draw. Now we kind of know a bit more our path. We've got these wins in the bag now. Where are your expectations? Are they increasing? Are you getting a better feeling about this team? Are you seeing something that you're like, yeah, this we could be going quarterfinal, semis, or where are your expectations?
It's a tough one, because so much of it is like, it depends. I think having Canada in our group, and with what's going on with the association at the moment, the players, you know, protesting against their federation, and, you know, that's tough. That's tough for them. If that's not resolved by the World Cup,
to be honest, I gotta say though, I'm not sure why anybody is surprised about this. I mean, Canada, high French population in Canada. So we really are surprised about the national team self-immolating before a World Cup. That's the French Canadians coming through right there.
I was just going to say, this might be the first time in Australian football that an incompetent federation has worked to our favour. So I'm really excited about that.
I mean, I hope that it's sorted. I hope they get their money before the World Cup. But of course,
yeah, you want the best players and teams here. Like,
yes.
Same as Spain.
But you know, it does open the door then to finish top of our group. If we finish top of our group, it's a much easier run to the semifinals than if we finish second. So,
let's not beat around the bush. If they finish second, they're getting eliminated by England in the round of 16.
I mean, Well, and unless we pull out another sort of one in a million performance, as we did against GB at the Olympics, but
They won't be coached by Gareth Southgate this time around. Not Gareth Southgate, Phil Neville.
Gareth Southgate, Phil Neville. Very true. Yes, it's I mean, there's still so many things. I mean, that second half kind of sums up still a lot of the frustrations with the team. And, you know, I was thinking about this earlier. They were kind of at a crossroads in the second half, because, yeah, you can't press like that for 90 minutes. You can't play at that intensity for 90 minutes, particularly in a tournament game. Like, imagine trying to do that in a quarterfinal or a semifinal or something. You know, you're not going to be able to do it. So, yes, you need to make substitutions. But in terms of attacking substitutions, you know, who comes on for Vine or for Raso? Like, really, there's no one really that can fill that role, unless you push, maybe you can push Kuni Cross out there. You can push Chidiak on the left of midfield. But there's no like-for-like replacements necessarily on the bench. Cromer came on as a kind of right wing-back, and I think was completely ineffective. I think was a very noticeable, you know, you're putting her on Ferrasso, who's had two wonderful games, and it was very noticeable. So I don't think that she's a solution. Gionic is not.
If you're picking Cromer to play right back, pick someone else.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, exactly. And again, maybe the solution is, you know, given Charlie Grant's form, maybe Ellie Carpenter comes back and plays in that right midfield spot. I mean, something like that.
I like it.
Well, yeah. But there's kind
of no...
Somewhere
she can zoom.
Zoomies. So we just zoomies for 90 minutes. like a greyhound, but with more endurance. but I think that, like...
I've always said greyhounds had no ticker. Just
absolutely none. But Cromer came on, didn't really do a job. Gionic's not going to come on and kind of do that job either. But there's been no one knocking down the door who's kind of an attacking player. And I thought to myself, well, there's kind of been one player who's been capped, actually, by Tony Gustafsson, and that is Beattie Goad. And I wonder if someone like her could fill that kind of role where I think that front four is the best front four, if all remains uninjured, will remain the front four. But then they're not going to be able to play that way for 90 minutes. So we need to think about players that can come in and actually fill those gaps. In a tournament, you know, nothing goes right in a tournament. Like, there's going to be – someone's going to get injured, someone's going to get niggles, someone's going to get – something's going to happen. In order to play our best, we have to play at this higher tempo. You need more players who are capable of doing that. You can't just, you know, say, well, this 11 is capable of doing it, but everyone on the bench isn't, because that's pointless.
Well, I got a question for you, Taryn. Potentially somebody who can come on in those situations. What about Holly McNamara?
Yes. Well, yes, that is the other option. And I'm so glad that you brought her up. She did score two goals in the past week against the Young Matildas in a friendly. Her first 45 minutes of action since doing her ACL. And that would be, you know, I would love for her to come out, knock down the door, you know, win the league with City, with Rojas coming back as well. And, you know, yeah, really make a barnstorming case for selection, because I think that's the kind of missing piece. We haven't had an attacking player knock down the door. Like, if you look at sort of the other options, you know, Chelsea Dorber hasn't had a great season. Remy Simpson hasn't had a great season. Did have a good season, but off the bench, went to Leicester, is injured, I think, at the moment, is not playing, so she's not, you know, really up for selection. Holly McNamara could be that missing piece of the puzzle as well. I think that's a really, really important element as well.
Does it have to be an out-and-out wide player in that role if it's a 4-4-2? Because we've got some pretty advanced wing-backs and full-backs as well. I mean, there are a lot of teams around the world who play with a sort of, I guess, false winger in that position. Like, you think of Atletico Madrid do it all the time, where it's almost a central midfielder in that role, and they kind of drift inside to make a three. Yes, this is just a way for me to shoehorn Chidiak into the formation. Yes, thank you for asking.
I mean, but yeah, but if you know, again, we were talking about playing your best players that are in form. It's not like rocket science. And Chidiak has been in tremendous form, and she made a huge difference when she came on against Czechia. Yes, she's absolutely, as a left-sided winger, absolutely an option. And I think, you know, Kaio Kunikross in midfield, I had sort of always had in my head, oh, is it Kaio Kunikross or is it Chidiak? To be fair, Kaio Kunikross does play slightly deeper in midfield, and she has grown in that role over time.
I still think Kaio Kunikross is better suited for when you're playing a game of basketball on a football pitch, though. When the game does slow down, I don't think that's suited to her skill set.
Yeah, and you can see there was one particular challenge she made against Czechia where she can sometimes be a slight liability in defense as well. In this case, she won the ball, but it was, you know, a kind of wild challenge, and she does those every second game which less than she did when she was younger, but still does that. So, yes, there's an argument there, but I do think if Alex Chidiak is going to come into this, is going to play more minutes, she's going to have to be utilised as that left midfielder as well, for sure.
I mean, I think it's pretty obvious at this point Tony Gustafsson sees, to use his parlance, Alex Chidiak as a game changer. somebody who he's going to bring in off the bench. But it does, it's been fascinating to for me to see just this midfield's heading into the Women's World Cup. Like Elise Keller-Knight is back in the team as well, but like somebody like Chloe Legazzo is still on the outside looking in, who at the start of this Women's World Cup cycle, Legazzo would have been considered a nailed-on, bolted-on starter. But she's still not playing for Western United. And really, and you're looking at this central midfield now and you're asking who comes out if you are going to bring Chloe Legazzo back in. I mean, is it an Emily Van Egmond who comes out, given that she's seemingly lost her place in the starting 11? But Emily Van Egmond, likewise, would have been considered one of these locked-on certain attendees at the start of this cycle. So it really is an interesting dynamic, because you can't drop somebody like Chidiak based on form, but she wasn't like entrenched in these plans at the start of the four-year cycle. So I'm really intrigued to see what that battle looks like heading into, well, we've got the April window, and then we've got the farewell games in June, and then the World Cup's on. So,
and to be honest with you, I think those are the questions that determine how deep we go in the World Cup. You can have a good, you know, we figured out a much better formula to play on the pitch, but it's those questions. It's, are we actually going to pick players on form? Because as we say, it's simple. Claire Hunt comes in because she's the best centre back in your domestic competition, and she does well. You know, it's very straightforward. Are we going to pick the best players on form, or are we not? And even if the starting 11 is functional and works, then when your options off the bench don't match that, that's going to determine how deep we go in the tournament.
Can I just say, it feels like I'm taking crazy pills every time I see Chidiak like pigeonholed as a super sub. Like, I honestly believe she's in the top three most important players in the team. It's just, it drives me nuts. It's like if Barcelona decided, oh, this Andres Iniesta is pretty handy off the bench, you know? Like, it's so, absolutely crazy to me.
We've they reached did. The point they where Josh is comparing Chidiak to Iniesta.
honestly, tell me why it's not a good comparison.
But I mean, at this point, like, we're not the coach. Tony Gustafsson's the coach, and we have to make these discussions within the framework that exists in the real world. It's like how when we discuss the A-League, we can't just relegate everybody because there's no relegation. It's that sort of thing.
Joey, it's our podcast. We can do what we like.
let me bring in rules to this, except under 90. That's the only rule.
All right. In that case, I think we should look to press on.
Well, just a couple of comments. Jess asked via YouTube, will Kennedy actually start this tournament? Taryn, thoughts?
I think she's carrying a knock, so that would suggest no.
She's constantly carrying a knock.
Well, yeah, but she's here. She's part of the squad. She traveled. But yeah, I don't think so on that basis.
All right. Just in a couple of other comments, Edmund said, Ford is arguably a better footballer than Kirk. Kirk is a horrible
that's a hot take. Standards.
That's a hot take. But you know what? I kind of see it. Like, I mean, this is like the hard thing. It's like, it feels a little bit like Henri Bergkamp kind of vibes. You know, different strikers, but maybe just the way you see football is what you like about them. Alan Riley, we're winning the Women's World Cup. Never doubted Tony G for a second. Never wanted him gone. Go, Tony. Woohoo. Four thumbs up. That's right, Alan. That's the spirit. All right,
one believed in us. No one believed in us. And then we beat Spain and we showed them. We showed them.
Beat Spain. Seh.
Anyway.
Remember when the Socceroos won 11 games in a row and we were going to just top the qualifying group and not have to do playoffs or anything?
Best ever World Cup, Joey. Best ever World Cup. Wash your mouth out. Get informed.
I don't want to have to do it again.
You didn't have to do it in the first place, you idiot.
Well, with that, I think we should congratulate Jens Fjellstrøm's Matildas on their win over Spain and head on over to to the Melbourne Derby. Taryn, do you want to stick around or you want to say goodbye for now?
I will say goodbye, but thank you for having me. I will come on soon for more soap eating shenanigans.
Thanks for Taryn Leaves. They called this podcast a soap opera. They didn't know how right they were.
You can listen to Taryn commentating on A-League Women games on 10Play. You can also catch Taryn on the Ladies League podcast. Where else can we find you, Taryn? I'm writing articles on matildas.com.au. Where else?
Yes. Largely those things.
Yeah, and Joey, we're not all like you with 8 gigs to support our income, all right? She's doing 3 gigs. Respect, Taryn. Well done. Good effort. That's enough. Yeah. Enjoy some rest.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks and success.
Freelance football expert Taryn Heddo with us tonight. Melbourne Victory 3, Melbourne City 2. A huge turn up for the books in the Melbourne derby. Joey, you were there. How did you see it?
Normally when you hear the term smash and grab, it's associated with like a 1-0 win. But this, this felt like it was sort of like a deserved smash and grab 3-2 win, if you know what I mean.
A deserved robbery. You're a victim blamer, Joey.
Well, yeah, like City had a lot of the ball. They had a lot of shots. I think they almost had as many passes in Melbourne's victory's half. Sorry, they
passes
had as many.
Half.
I think they had as many completed passes in Melbourne's victory's half as victory had completed passes total. But at the same time, I don't think it's fair to declare this an outright bank robbery. I think Melbourne victory were disciplined. I think Melbourne victory defended doggedly. I think Paul Izzo came up with some crucial saves at the big moments. Yes, Melbourne City had enough chances to win this game. Jamie McLaren, 91st minute, somehow manages to put a header over the crossbar from the top of the six-yard box. Don't know how you managed that one, Nick Nabano. But at the same time, I wouldn't have declared it a travesty if City won, but I'm not going to declare it a travesty that victory won. And this was a win that victory absolutely bloody needed. Like, if they lost, they would have gone 10 points back of the top six and we could have drawn a line through their season. They were done. We could be doing that next week. But right now, we're not because they're still alive.
Welcome, Nick Dabano, to the show. Nick, we'll start with your thoughts on the derby. Melbourne victory with only their 5th win of the season against the top of the table, seemingly unbeatable cyborg that is Melbourne City. I mean, how? How?
Well, hello, guys. First of all, appreciate the introduction, Joey. The low blow saying for my miss from 8 yards out without even asking, hey, Nick, how are you? First of all, in terms of the derby, well, I'll tell you what, it was a fun game, good game of football. I really enjoyed it. I mean, we talk about on this podcast making Australian football fun. That was a lot of fun. And to be honest, as you mentioned, Joey, I think it was a deserved win for Melbourne victory. They did everything exactly to the book. I thought that they played quite well. I mean, the Josh Brillante goal, there was some talk about a bit of controversy with the throw-in or something like that. The City players were really up in arms about, it shouldn't have, something about it shouldn't have happened or something about the throw-in. It was pointed one way, then went back the other way. I think Alireza Fagani was like, I think he initially gave City the throw-in and the assistant was like, nah, don't worry about it. It's actually victory. And City were lining up for an attacking throw-in. And then victory got the throw-in. It went forward and they were in sixes and sevens. That's why they looked so open when Brillante broke forward. But I mean, like in terms of narrative and everything, it was awesome. I mean, Bruno Fornaroli scoring against City. What more could you ask for? I mean, that in itself is an awesome storyline.
He didn't even bother to do that. I'm not going to celebrate, scoring in the derby against my old team, the team that brought me to Australia, the team that I'm a legend at. He celebrated it like he hated them, and I loved it.
Can I just say, I have a yarn about this very phenomenon that should be coming out tomorrow in ESPN that touches on numerous topics, including that one. But we did actually ask Bruno, myself and Shane Hope from AAP. We grabbed Bruno afterwards and asked him about that, and he said, yeah, of course I'm going to celebrate. I need to show Melbourne Victory fans how much I care about this sort of club sort of thing. So that's what was going through his mind.
He ran into his ex and then wanted to tell his girlfriend or boyfriend. He was like, nah, 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 nah. Oh, them. Oh, nah, hate them. oh, not keen on them at all. You're the one who I'm massively into. No, they're ugly.
I think he's right. I think he needs to show that he, you know, victory is, you know, his home now, and he's not, because he's so close. If it was any other player that had played for City for a couple of seasons or whatever, you know, it wouldn't have mattered quite so much. But because Fornaroli, his kind of image and his career is so closely associated with Melbourne City, I think he does have to prove that, you know, where his loyalties lie now. Nick?
I still think it's unbelievable, like, when you really think about it, like last week when we were sort of preparing, you know, content leading into the derby and sort of having a look back at old Bruno Fornaroli highlights from the derby when he's wearing a Melbourne City jersey and some of those amazing games where, you know, he terrorised victory and he terrorised victory fans. I mean, especially in that first season. And it's like, this guy is now playing for Melbourne Victory. Like, when you take back, like, you take just a step back, you go like, oh my God, this is like, you tell me this in 2016, I'd tell you, you're crazy. Like, there's no way this guy is going to end up playing for victory. But so it's an awesome little narrative. And as you mentioned, Josh, like, I hope this can spark a bit of a decent end to the season for him. He's had a bit of a tough time at victory. Hasn't scored probably in the same amount that he probably would have hoped to, probably what victory fans would have hoped to. I know that now he's obviously not at the peak of his career now, but he can still be a very valuable player. I think there aren't many players in the league that can still hold the ball up as well as Bruno Fornaroli in the entire league. I still think he's very valuable. But for me, the two players that really stood out for victory, like, you know, Damien De Silva, I think is a really, really handy signing. He looks like a good find for them. I mean, like, the guy was playing for Lyon this season, so there has to be some pedigree there. He's last in Ligue 1 for that long. I think that signing has kind of gone under, sort of floated under the radar a little bit, even though he is sort of at that age of 35, to the point that if it works out for him, I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, I wouldn't say it's Mathieu Delpierre levels, but I think there is something to it that, you know, he could end up being someone who's a very handy player. But Paul Izzo, I mean, he barely trained in the lead up like for weeks, and he came in and some of the saves he was making, just throwing his body on the line. There was one at the end there where Richie van der Ven like collected him, almost kicked him straight in the head. And he made this unbelievable save, just threw his body on the line, the desperation, not just from him, but from everyone. It showed how much the game meant to victory, and their season's now still alive. And to be honest, I know they're 7 points out, but I would not be surprised if they go on a run and steal sixth spot. Like, I'm putting it blunt. Like, I think that there is enough quality in that team to do it. I think if they get a bit of momentum, I think they can get it done. And the league is so tight. I don't think the teams necessarily above them have put enough of like that sort of gap and sort of enough sort of body of work on the field to suggest they're that much better than Victory. I think Victory can easily close the gap, potentially sneak into the top six. And they're going to be that one team you won't want to play if you get into the top six as well, because, you know, they know how to win games when they're up and going, and they've got enough quality and enough players that can get the job done on any given day.
Nick, I'm not surprised that you're a fan of Damien De Silva, because has anyone ever seen you, Jamie McLaren, and Damien De Silva in the same room?
Well, I'm not saying that one.
There could be a relation there. I'm just saying there's Damien a passing resemblance.
Damien De Silva looks more like,
for those who have seen Better Call Saul, more like Lalo Salamanca. I mean, that's sort of the first sort of, you know, thing that I thought when I saw it. But yeah, I mean, no one's seen us all in the room. I mean, I can't comment on that. I can't comment.
I'm just saying, let's do the 23andMe and see what happens. Stoll?
Well, I just wanted to say last week, I was talking all about how, you know, the Melbourne City, what they're up against now is the history books. They, you know, the most points is in play. The most amount of wins is in play. Jamie McLaren, most goals is in play. And then I feel like we put way too much pressure on them. You know, they lost the derby to the bottom team. That's not a great start, but...
I think we have established that Melbourne City, nobody that plays for Melbourne City listens to this pod, because if they were, none of us would, they would never talk to us again after, you know, what did Ante christen the front three last season? ASS.
Yeah, but that was Ante, you know, Ante christened the league ASS.
Right? And not once did anyone ask him to wash his mouth out. So I'm wondering why I've copped it, you know?
But what I want to say about City was, you know, look, it's a loss and whatever, but Matthew Leckie is, look, the Make Australian Football Fund Society, Max Burgess, number one player. But 1A is Matthew Leckie. Matthew Leckie is so fun to watch right now. This dude is in red hot form. The touch that he took, that first touch he took for the second goal there, was amazing. Leckie had so many moments in this game that I was just like, this guy actually Like, he came back from Europe and I was thinking, okay, well, you know, we're not going to get the best of Matthew Lecky anymore. And, you know, we'll just see, like we see with most soccerers who come back, they do okay for a couple of years and they just kind of fade out and injuries get the better of them. And I'm looking at Lecky like, bro, you got to go back to Europe. Like, relax with City. You're go to Manchester City. You're killing it at the moment. I love watching Matthew Lecky play. I actually think he should be kind of the Johnny Warren medalist at this stage.
I mean, it is remarkable. Like, I remember, I can't even remember who said it now, but just like there were people declaring him washed and like just a fraud when he first came out. Now he's the best player in the league. Tony Popovich just flat out said post-game, yeah, Matthew Lecky's the best player in the league. Like,
he's even better than I thought he was. Like, I don't even remember seeing his performances in Europe.
It's the same sort of like phenomena that you see with Robbie Cruz. You don't play for a decade in the Bundesliga unless you're a really good football player. Like, you don't represent the Socceroos as much as they have and played in the Bundesliga as much as they did if you're not a really good football player. So, of course, he's, you know, one of the best players and right now the best player in the league. On the silver as well, I thought it was really interesting. One of the things Tony Popovich said post-game, he said he thanked the club for backing him after he fought hard for the silver. So it sounds like that's a Tony Popovich signing right there. It's somebody that Tony Popovich has gone out and identified and fought for. And during the week, they put the silver up for media, probably because he'd only been in the country for 1.5 weeks, so nobody could ask him about the last derby. But De Silva talked about how Popovich and him discussed just defending on the phone before he arrived in Melbourne. So it really feels like De Silva is one of Popovich's boys. So it's going to be really interesting to watch that one going forward.
Do you ever call up anyone just talk about defending on the phone?
I never played as a World Cup as a centre back, so it's not a one-to-one comparison.
I want to hear that chat. That's fascinating.
I actually really do as well. I asked Popper about it, and he just like brick walled me, and I'm like, you bastard! I want to hear.
He's a former centre back, so they will do that to you. You know,
it's the centre backs union.
Yeah. I mean, Matthew Lecky beating Izzo at his near post. Yes, it was a consolation goal in the end, but that's one of the few instances where I thought that's actually not the keeper's fault at all. Like, that was an absolute bullet.
Yeah.
Not the worst instance of a keeper being beaten in his near post this week.
Oh, no. Are you talking about Meslier for Leeds against Everton?
No, I was talking about Redmayne against Brisbane.
No. You got to see the Leeds Everton highlights. Unbelievable. Talk about getting this guy came out for a cross when there was no one in the box and left his goal wide open.
Are we talking about goalkeeper stuff, like, you know, bloopers? Did we see what happened with Mark Birigidi this morning? The poor bloke, like, that was so unfortunate. Like, the back pass that dislocated, was he hurt? Did he dislocate his shoulder in the fall or something? Like, you know, when you're just having a bad day, like, I feel for him, man. Like, yeah.
That's why are you laughing so much, Tom? Nah,
because, like, look, admittedly, again, it's not good when these things happen. But at the same time, what are you going to tell me? It's not funny? It is funny. Like, I'm sorry. We all, like, the keeper stuffs up and then gets injured. It's like, oh, bro, like, everything's going wrong. Look, Nick Pope for Newcastle, you know, I put it on my Twitter. The guy misjudges the ball, gets hit in the face, pretends nothing happens, uses his hands, then tries to clear the ball, kicks his own teammate, gets sent off, misses the cup final. Just that, like, that is so funny that all those things happen in like 2 seconds. Like, it's just like at any point, you're like, just stop moving. Just stop doing what you're doing. Oh, man. Really nice comment from Joseph.
Very, very, very funny, Joseph. We're not going to touch that one. I mean, Nick, yes. Debano, I should say.
No.
Do you think this is a turning point for Victory in their season, or is it just one of those derby games that comes and goes? It's like lightning in a bottle for Victory, and they can play on the back foot, they can play on the counter attack. They've got extra motivation for this game, and it's just, you know, good goalkeeping performance, what have you. Or is this a sign of things to come? Well, where would you put your money if you had to?
Well, I mean, they've beaten arguably one of the best ever teams in the history of the A-League. Like, it's a pretty decent result, considering, as Joseph put in the comments before, there were some people saying, is this the worst Melbourne Victory team ever? Which I definitely don't think it is, because we have short-term memories if we forget 2 seasons ago and the team that was put out, you know, I was watching old
respect highlights. Jim Magilton.
Yeah. No, not Jim Magilton. I'm talking about the Steve Keane era. But anyway, like,
who was in charge when they lost the derby 6-0 and then lost the second derby 7-0? Who was that?
Redknapp.
That was Brebner.
Right, I'm sorry, Brebs. That's the worst I've ever seen in football.
That was institutional rot as well.
Yeah. Whatever. You can't lose a derby 6-0. They hold up the signs that say 6 and then you lose 7-0. That's like forfeit the game. It's better. It's better.
I mean, a line was certainly crossed there. So
Just on your
point. Hold on. The 7-0, it was hilarious. I actually asked Val and Borussia before the week about the 7-0 if he'd heard about it. Bloke looked like an evil grin, just like, yeah.
Oh, that's all they talk about.
Maybe he was too excited. They were like, relax, Val. You know, we need you to calm down, mate. Not the first time a Borussia got too excited at the A-League.
Yeah, in a derby game, wouldn't be the first time. No. Dubano, you were interrupted.
I was just going to say, I mean, proof will be in the pudding in the next few weeks. But I mean, if they're going to play like that, I think that there is certainly reason for optimism. I mean, I know they lost against the Jets in the sort of that, like, sandwich the two wins they've had, but they beat Wellington, they beat Melbourne City. That's two pretty decent results. Adelaide and Sydney will be very, very big games for them. I mean, like, they kind of have to win those games to really stay in it, or at least get probably around 4 points. But when you look at them statistically, like, they're actually not that bad. I mean, as much as they've conceded a lot of goals, and defensively, they're actually ranking one of the best defenses in the league, but they leak the most amount of goals just from errors. Like, a lot of them are just like individual errors and things that, you know, can be, you know, sort of cut out of the game, you know, and stuff that, you know, can be stamped out. And they're I think they're the worst team when it comes to, you know, underperforming their XG and chance creation, like, you know, not converting on the chances that they've got. Like, it's actually quite remarkable. So really, they're a team that, you know, are not scoring as much as they should, but also conversely, they're making a lot of, you know, uncharacteristic errors that are costing them, because overall, they're actually not defending that bad. So I think that, you know, going forward, it's going to be an interesting test against Adelaide, because Adelaide, you know, like, we know what they're going to bring sort of going forward. They're going to be a very sort of cross heavy team. They're going to, you know, bombard down the flanks. It's going to make for a really intriguing matchup out wide. But I mean, they drew with them 1-1 back in January, and they probably were unlucky not to win that game. This is at Amy Park. They're a better team now than I think they were in January. I think if a bit of cohesion now with De Silva coming in and getting a bit of sort of continuity in that side, come out with a win in that game, and suddenly you're thinking, all right, like, they're right in the hunt. But they've got to really start to hone in on that, like, close that 7-point gap. Still is, it's a big mountain. You know, 7 points is still a while to go. But I still think that they can go on a streak and still sneak in. So I guess we'll just have to wait and see what happens in the next little bit. But very curious to see what happens on Sunday.
That passing triangle in the lead up to the Fornaroli goal with Kadete, I think it was Brimmer and Falami. Is that the best bit of football the Victory have played all year?
100%.
I think it might be.
Yeah. 100%.
That was the most cohesive I've seen them look in any attack.
Probably bar the Nani cross in the first big blue, that beautiful cross. I think it was for Economides or for Brillante. I think
it was Economides.
Yes. Yeah. It was that lovely, like, cutting ball through the rock.
I'm talking about a team move.
A team goal. Yeah, yeah.
That was hands down the best football that Victory have put together all year for my money. And I was actually quite shocked to see it happen and unfold. I was like, where did this team come from? Like, this is a totally different proposition. I still think there's, like, a few weaknesses in terms of the just midfield composition. Like, Chapman is a holding midfielder. I'm still iffy on that. Maybe that was worked in a derby game against City, but when they have to take the initiative, I'm not sure. And then Brimmer,
the midfield is a massive weakness.
Yeah, obviously.
Yeah.
But Brimmer specifically, when he's inside his own half and receiving the ball, like, from his centre backs, there was one giveaway which didn't lead to anything, I don't think, but it was just like an atrocious decision making from him, and a really poor pass. And he's so good in the final third, and he's so good with his dead balls and everything, and his final ball delivery. But then when you ask him to sort of drop back and help in build up, which is probably a function of playing like a centre back in midfield like Chapman, I don't know. It doesn't really click for me. So we do have to talk about the belt, though. Because there was a belt change for the first time in a long time, Stoll.
Good job, Melbourne Victory. We love a Liga belt change with Jordy Boss previously. I think he held it for 5 or 6 weeks, or maybe even longer.
2 months.
2 months. A long holding. He was holding on to that belt for a very long time. But because Melbourne Victory beat Melbourne City, we are going to crown a new belt holder. And Nick DiBano, who is the current A-Liga belt holder?
Paul Izzo.
Paul Izzo. Congratulations, Paul. And what I want to know from you guys, and let us know in the comments, whenever you guys hear the name Izzo, do you guys always think H to the Izzo? Do you think it every single time? Like, there's never a time I've never seen Izzo and not the H to the Izzo. I'm hoping the A-Liga belt changes that. I'm hoping now we see Izzo, we think A-Liga belt, not a Jay-Z song from 20 years ago now.
Still bops, man. What a song.
Yeah, still good song. I wonder how sick he is of that. But yeah, incredible. And it makes the A-Liga belt race so much more exciting going in. So well done. Congratulations to Paul Izzo.
Well, let's move on to Adelaide 4, Western Sydney Wanderers 4.
We've got some breaking news.
We had the breaking news.
We've got some breaking news.
Apologies. Warren Moon has been officially sacked by Brisbane Roar. So we obviously delayed the podcast just to bring you this news. It wasn't anything to do with our own personal lives getting in the way. This is quite surprising to me because I thought the Roar were quite happy to ticker along in sort of absentee caretaker mode under the Bakeries for the foreseeable future, Joey.
It's interesting. The lunar eclipse has descended across Brisbane Roar.
Horrible.
Yeah, wow. And it is especially interesting after a draw. I mean, you're right. The question was never was there justification for sacking Warren Moon. Warren Moon himself coming out after a few games during this adverse run of form, admitting that he basically cut a figure sounding like, this isn't good enough. Something's going to have to change. Starting to make the noises that you begin to hear from coaches when they know it's inevitable. But yeah, I didn't think the Roar would sack him, pay him out, and then bring somebody else in mid-season. I mean, it's interesting. Marco Monteverde, who up there in Queensland generally has a pretty good insight into what is going on at the Roar. He's reported that former Brisbane City coach Nick Green is going to be appointed into the role. He was at Brisbane City for one season. I think he got them from last to fourth. Then he got sacked. There was some sort of dispute. And he's been coaching in private academies ever since. So it's a very out there appointment. And it doesn't smack of a bloke that we have to move right now. Otherwise, somebody else is going to sneak in and steal him away. I mean, you've had Ben Kahn sitting on your doorstep for how many years if you really wanted an NPL coach? It sits in this weird little universe of being, one, understandable, but two, very surprising. And let's be honest. I mean, it's been said on this show in the past. I think Vince Rogari said it in the past. Many people have said it in the past. With this club, with Brisbane Roar, they sort of don't get the benefit of the doubt with any of their decision-making at this point, do they? Could it work? Is it the right move? Maybe, but it's Brisbane. Probably not.
I mean, look, what I'd say is, and this is probably a combination of factors, but I have not enjoyed watching Brisbane Roar for a long time. And that probably predates the Warren Moon era. Definitely was in the Robbie Fowler era as well. So, you know, I guess you kind of feel like Brisbane Roar, there are so many issues at the club. I don't think that this is all down to Warren Moon and that, you know, their struggles are down to him. Even when I saw their roster at the start of the season, I didn't expect big things from this team. I'm sure if you go back and listen to our preview podcast, I had Brisbane last or maybe second last around that kind of area. But that was for too long because I think I said I had Victory to win the whole thing. So don't worry about that.
We all did stop.
Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. In a way, I kind of feel a little sorry for Warren Moon, but at the same time, like, their football has not been good. Obviously, they had for a little while, it looked like they were picking up some draws and you know, kind of getting some results. But when your football's not good and the results go, what do you have left? And that's kind of what I think has happened with Brisbane Roar. So, yeah, like I don't see a massive, the club's now going to turn around and be flying after this appointment. But I just think there are much bigger questions that need to be asked about the Brisbane Roar for the health of the league. because they are an important part of the league.
I mean, Dabani, you want to jump in?
Oh, no, I was just going to say really like just a small point. I mean, Warren Moon, I think when you look at his whole coaching tenure, he's actually done okay. I mean, he made finals twice. And I know that recently the results have sort of dipped, but as you mentioned, Stoll, he kind of wasn't really working with much. I mean, like he did in his first season and a half, when he took over the hub period and he got them into the six. I know they went out quite early in the finals. They went out in the first round against Western United. Then the next year they lost the home final against Adelaide. But I mean, that second season in particular, like people were waxing lyrical about Moonball and saying like, geez, they actually play a real progressive brand. You know, they got some real saucy players. I mean, that was when Riku Danzaki was first year and he was playing some really good football. And then things kind of fell away last season and then fell away again this year. But, I mean, he had to kind of change his philosophy based off what he had. I mean, he wasn't really working with much. But I think that he's not completely lost to the league. I think that he's actually not as bad of a coach as probably people think. And I think that I wish him all the best because I really hope that, you know, this isn't the last we see of him, at least at an A-League level. But I think that, you know, if he has any sort of, you know, opportunities potentially outside the A-League, if there's an NPL opportunity potentially on the way, maybe, you know, clubs might have to take a look at that down the track. But I think that, you know, he's certainly one to keep an eye on in years to come. And, yeah, I think that he deserves another go at it at some point. Maybe not straight away, but definitely down the track.
Agree.
Joe?
Okay, one thing before I get to my serious point. Remember a while ago, we had a bit of a blow up, bit of an argument where I took issue with a graphic calling Brisbane Roar a force.
Joey.
They haven't won a game since, and now Warren Moon's been sacked.
Well, they didn't say a force for good, a force for evil. It was just a force. It's a force. A force can go in any direction. So
I was right. But again, every time we talk about the Brisbane Roar, things going on, we've been talking about A-League expansion as of late. It's been coming up in the news cycle again. It's sort of like the great, something's gone wrong, quick point at expansion. But if I, and putting aside to one side my own philosophical objections and my desire to just fill up the A-League via an open pyramid, you start up a second division and you get 16 teams by just promoting teams from that. If we are going to do it the traditional way, picking a catchment area, picking a market and just plonking a new entity there, you have to put a second team in Brisbane. You have to provide some sort of competition, some sort of actual impetus to demand improvements. Because as, you know, has been pointed out, Stoll just said, Brisbane, Queensland, going by participants, Queensland is now the second largest footballing state in the country. You need, even on that metric alone, if Melbourne can support three teams, Queensland should be able to support two. But even not putting that aside, you need to give some sort of impetus and just kick out the backside to get this Raw team into action, that if they're not going to get kick into gear, give fans in Brisbane another option. And if the Raw want to keep those fans, they have to get better and to improve, because we'll probably have a Brisbane team in the second division. Probably not many, probably just one, but there'll be one. And then if there's another A-Leagues team in Brisbane, all of a sudden they're going to have to earn those fans. They're not going to be a monopoly anymore. So I think that's important.
Well, what's next for Warren Moon? I vote he gives into the gravitational pull of the center of the universe and comes to NPL Victoria. Sure.
Hold on. Which team? Appoint him, Josh. Josh,
Bentley Greens.
Nick Dabano, where's he go? Warren Moon in the center of the universe.
There's no vacancies, so no spots.
Sack someone. There will be soon.
Sack someone. Sack someone.
Well, I don't know. I wanted to sack lots of people.
Lose their job. No.
Yeah, yeah. No. Well, like, 2 weeks ago, you wouldn't let me get mutual with anyone. Now you're demanding sackings.
After round one, this is... all right, let's go to... Adelaide 4, Western Sydney Wanderers 4. Just one of your classic madcap A-League games. Awesome. I feel like Adelaide's always got one of these in them. You know, it certainly did in the Gertjan Verbeek era. And maybe Carl Vaart was, Viet was paying tribute to that. Stoll, what did you think of this one?
Well, this game, it was 3 p.m. on a Sunday, and I checked the weather in Adelaide. It was 30 degrees. and it was the human handbrake, Carl Veer, against, you know, Western Sydney under Tony Popovich, not exactly known for scintillating attacking under Tony football. Popovich. Mark Ridden. Sorry. I got
Mark Ridden.
Australian Croatian defenders.
Marco.
Yeah, okay, relax. anyway, it was one of those games where I was like, to be honest with you, I was like, this is not going to be good. This is just, you know, if I just didn't happen to be home right now, I wouldn't be watching this. And you turn it on, and then, you know, it was a bit of a slow start, and then, you know, there's a goal, and then Borrello scored that amazing goal. And this is where it started to get amazing, because Borrello scores that incredible goal that you rarely see, where they, you know, a player hits the wall, the rebound comes back, and then the other player just smashes it top corner. Big vibes of like, let me show you how it's done. He goes to the sideline. I don't know if it was to celebrate with Rudes, but Rudes was not in the mood for celebrating. He went there, and even the players, they're running over, and they're all joyous, and then they just immediately got some instructions, which is like, all right, killing the vibe a bit. The instructions were, let's just get to halftime, and then we push. And what happened? In the 4 minutes of injury time, Adelaide had the ball in the back of the net twice. Thank God one of the goals was ruled out for offside, because I feel like Rudes would have killed people at halftime. The second half was incredible, and Carl Veer losing his mind on the sideline added to it. The red card added to it. Iran Kunda added to it. Amazing goals, amazing game. Like, this was actually one of those games which, because I actually wanted to leave to go to this Fair Day event, and I was hooked. I couldn't get off my couch. And, you know, in terms of, you know, make Australian football fun, this was one of the funnest games I've ever seen in the A-League. And I didn't expect it at all. And maybe that's also why it was so fun. But, you know, just well done to both sets of players. You know, Nieuwenhof scoring an amazing goal. You know, the goal right at the end to make it 4-4. That was an incredible finish. So really, truly one of my favorite games that I've seen in a long, long time.
I mean, that Amal Leone solo effort is got to be up there for goal of the season, just in terms of like the circumstance it was scored in as well, and chipping the ball between two players, taking on a third. Unbelievable, Nick.
Yeah, I'm stock sim fam all Leone, guys. I am all in box office.
That's all we needed to see.
No, because you know what? Like, I was listening to Marco Rudan's press conference today, and he actually said, you know, like, this is nowhere near the best of Amal Leone. He's still acclimatizing to the Australian summer. I mean, he's come from 0 degrees in Scandinavia to now 30 degree days here in Australian summer. It's going to take him time to acclimatize. You know, he hasn't been playing as much in preseason over there. I mean, he looks like a real find. And I know that, you know, he's not a high NRI signing, and I know that he doesn't come with, you know, playing in the quote-unquote top leagues. But if you actually look at his stats throughout his career in Scandinavia, in Egypt, everywhere else, he has an awesome record of, you know, goals and assists. I know we joke about goals and assists, but the guy's a goals and assists machine. And in 45 minutes, what did he do? He got an assist and he got a goal. Mm. And I'll tell you what, like, he came on, he was showing energy down the right-hand side, as you said, like, he saw two players in front of him and he's like, stuff it, I'm going to take this myself. And he split them, jumps through them and scores that unbelievable goal. And it's like, Jesus, this guy makes me want to watch the Wanderers every single week. Because like between him and Yenge and Borrello, the way he's playing at the moment, and Neuwenhof, I know the Wanderers have been playing a little bit more of a defensive style of play. But when these guys are on the field to just say, all right, let's cook, let's get these guys going. They've got a lot of individual quality, a lot of quality in that final third that makes, you know, me excited to watch more. I think a lot of people excited as well. So I'm looking forward to seeing more of Amal Leone. I reckon he's going to be a player that could just blow. I could look really wrong in a few weeks' time, but this guy could absolutely go nuts and end this season on a high. And I hope then, if he does well, the Wanderers bring him back on a permanent deal. He's only here on loan as well until the end of the season.
He could be a big Streets Don't Forget player. He could be the ultimate Streets Don't Forget player. Even if
I get a feeling he's just going to score. Like, every goal he scores is going to be fun. Like, it's going to be bangers. Yeah. He's going to do step overs. He's going to take players on. I reckon it's going to be great.
How about Alan Riley in the comments? Shouldn't have been able to beat five players with two touches. Horrible Adelaide defending. When a game's 4-3, all right, defending's gone out the window. As much as, you know, Tony Popovich and De Silva might chat about it on the phone, all right, that's where all chaos goes. And you know what? It's not about the A-League level, because you see it like Champions League when or World Cups, when the game's just exploded and it's end-to-end and everyone's just losing their heads. It's actually the best. Even though Geraldo makes a good point that the Make Australian Football Sustainably Fund Society, well, I'd like that a little less. Takes issue with this fun by accident game. And it probably just further encourages risk adverse coaches to be risk adverse. Look, yeah, what I don't want to see, Rudes and Carl Viet working on defending this week and, you know, making sure that they're, all right, boys, we conceded 4. No, you scored 4. Focus on the good. All right, let's enjoy.
Just a small point on Adelaide. I know we call like the running gag about Carl Viet's nickname, but Adelaide have scored a lot of goals in the last few weeks. I think they've scored something like, they've scored 7 in their last 2. And I think in like their last 4 or 5 games, they've scored, now quick maths, 3, 5, 8, 12 goals in their last 4 games. That's an average of 3 a game. I mean, like, they might not play the most exciting brand with their midfield partnership and stuff, but far out, they score a lot of goals. And like, they're creating a lot of chances. And I mean, again, Nestorio and Kunda coming on in the second half and doing what he does. I mean, whenever he's on the field to that box office, he was unbelievable when he came on again. And he, you know, again, changed the games.
And doesn't it show you the value of a dribbler in those situations? Someone who can run at players, someone who can run at players who are on yellow cards, cause chaos, make, you know, play defenders make decisions whether that, okay, if I take him out, I'm going to get sent off. But if I don't take him out, he's going to run straight through. So, yeah, just a awesome.
You know what actually impressed me the most about that cameo is the bit where he didn't run with the ball, the pauser before the cross. Ooh. There were 3 defenders converging on him and none of them wanted to make a challenge because they were all too scared to dive in because Aaron Kunda just, you know, makes you look like a fool when you do that. So they were all just jockeying. What's he going to do? And he did a couple of little feints and he just stayed and waited. And then he chipped it in between them and it led to the goal. And I thought that's a sign of a maturing footballer. And that really like that gave me the warm and fuzzies for the future of Australian football.
You know, you've made it at 16 years old when defenders are scared of you, what you're going to do when the ball's at your feet. But 2, when the opposition coach is speaking after the game saying, I knew that he was going to come on and we had to be better prepared for it. Rudes actually said, my instinct was in that moment, went 3-2 up, was to bring on an extra defender, but he sort of went against his gut and didn't want to shut up shop. And he said, that's a learning curve for me next time when I know they've got a player like that and I know they're going to come at us, to maybe bring on an extra defender and look to shut up shop a little bit quicker. So, you know, like when you're getting that, those compliments from opposition players and opposition coaches at 16, you can't help but get excited about him. He's going to be an unbelievable player if he continues on his trajectory.
Look, it's very different, and I'm absolutely not comparing Aaron Kunda to Messi, but there's a famous game where Messi's 18 years old and he's playing against Chelsea in the Champions League, and it's this horrible, horrible pitch, right? And basically what happened, the Chelsea players have talked about it. They were like, no, the game plan was basically kick the crap out of this kid. And by the way, Ronaldinho's on the other side of the pitch. Like, that's how good that an 18-year-old Messi was. They were just like, we got to destroy this kid, otherwise he's going to destroy us. And what happened? A red card after 30 minutes. He'd ripped all of them about 8 times. And, you know, Aaron Kunda's nowhere near that, never going to get that. Let's just all calm down. But it can still be the same thought, the same psychology, the same, this kid is so good that we have to change, like you say, our entire defensive strategy for it, which then frees up other players like Goodwin, like Halloran, like Ibasuki to get goals and assists.
Well, yeah, I was speaking with Ernie Merrick on Saturday. Massive fan of Nestor and Kunda. Thinks he's going to be an absolute superstar as the chief football officer. So he's at least got one friend in Football Australia headquarters over there.
Geraldo in the comments saying, what I'm not excited about is him making me feel old by being born after the A-League started. ain't that the truth? And yes, Lazar 11 pointing out he just turned 17. So that's right.
Apologies for that to Nestor.
There's another youngster who I'm going to be interested in to look at watching from this game, watching forward. Nicholas Milanovic, again, coming off the bench for Western Sydney Wanderers. I think long-term, Nicholas Milanovic is going to be the best signing of the January transfer window, albeit it's, you know, the clubs have come out and said that it was sort of a family-driven move. So how much credit can you actually give the Wanderers for recruiting him? I don't know. But looking at that Wanderers front line now, so they've obviously got, we've been singing Leiuni's praises. Yangi's back, Borrello's there. And then behind them, Neuenhoff, Bozanic, Amalfitano, Milanovic, and Miloš Ninković as well. How are they going to get all these guys minutes?
Well, Ninković hasn't actually started a game since the Sydney Derby. And I mean,
because he's been hurt. But like when Miloš Ninković is fully fit and like he's raring to go and up for it, is he going to be content coming off the bench? Do you even want to relegate Miloš Ninković to the super sub? Is he a case of you get 60 good minutes out of him and then take him off? I don't know. It's a juggling act for Rudan.
Well, good problems to have when he's got that many options.
But I'd be disappointed if Milanovic got lost in the shuffle and barely saw the field as a result.
Yeah, absolutely. Shall we move on to the Jets? Because three wins from their last four games. They're back up to seventh in the table. They're equal on points with Sydney and Wellington ahead of them. Dare we say it, are the Jets back?
With a twist. They're a bit, like I must say, recently they have looked a lot better defensively. Like in the last few weeks, They've solidified themselves a lot more defensively. And I must say, I got to give credit. Carl Jankinson has been very, very good for them in the heart of defense. I mean, Saturday was a weird game. I mean, that game went for 4 hours, right? Like that wasn't even that in itself was just like a weird, you know, like just battle of attrition. Like who could stay focused for the longest? Like, you know, you two rain delays that go for that long. I mean, that would weigh on anyone warming up, warming down. You know, not knowing if the game's going ahead. They got that early.
The game had also been delayed already. Like the kickoff had been delayed. So what time was it meant to finish? It was meant to finish at like 5 p.m.
So the game was meant to originally start at 5. And it got moved back an hour. So the game was meant to start then at 6 because of the heat.
Yeah.
So finish at 8.
Good call.
And then the game finished at 9:59. Right before the 4 hours.
What is this? An episode of TNC?
Because when I was covering the game, I was watching the clock. I'm like, please let it get to 10 o'clock. I want it. 4 hours sounds so much better than 3 hours 59. 3 hours 59 does not sound good. 4 hours sounds better. But you know what? Credit to them. They're winning games. And that's what's important right now for them, considering how close things are. You know, Becker's playing a lot better up front. I know Reno Piscopo didn't play before that. He was playing really well in those past few games before he got injured in the warm-up, playing more as a 10. You know what? Good on him. Good on him now for putting, you know, some of those doubts to rest, because right now they're right in the mix. And I honestly think that they should be considered a finals contender, because, you know, they got Western United coming up next week, which, you know, they probably should win at home. They can get there. They're playing well enough. I'm confident. 6 games unbeaten now. It's a decent run.
What I will say is also a little bit of a fixture run in terms of they played MacArthur. MacArthur aren't doing well since Dwight York left. They played Victory, who obviously had the great result against City, but bottom of the table. They played Perth, who is struggling this season.
That's Macedonia Park, though.
That's true. But hot and cold. They played Brisbane, obviously, just like their coach. So there's issues there. And they also played against the Wanderers as well, which is an impressive result. But I guess sometimes this is also the thing with – sometimes you do just have to look at the fixture list in both ways. When a team's struggling, go, oh, they haven't won a game in 5. And it's like, well, they played the top 5 sides. So over the course of the season, eventually the box will eventually be box office.
Okay. Are we just going to move past the fact that Debano just called you Lockie by accident?
Sorry, you
two are spending too much time together.
The winds of change are running through.
When he literally sits in the desk next to you, you know, that is an obvious sort of thing that, you know, you're going to mistake the person that, you know, you sit next to for 8 hours a day, you know, so it happens. It's been a long day.
I don't mind. It's a sign that the show should come to an end soon.
Yes. Well, if we've got no further topics. So if there's any topics you want us to discuss in the chat, please get to it. But in the meantime, the NPLs around Australia are back. We were at it in commentary. The Victorians in the call. We're back behind the microphone. Debano, Joey, you were there for the season opener. Moreland City 1, South Melbourne 2. How was that game, Nick?
I had a lot of fun. It's just good to be back in the NPL. But you know what the best part about it was? Just like the shock value of the first half. I remember, because obviously Moreland City, for those who don't know, I mean, 75 years out of the top flight, you know, not many people expected them. Everyone had them, including yourself, Joey, and Josh, as the predicted to finish bottom this season and coming up against South Melbourne. Not much of a bigger game you can really schedule for your first game back in the top flight. And they took it to them in the first half, and they took the lead right on half time. I remember looking at Joey thinking, geez, this is going to happen, isn't it? Like, they're going to cause, like, the absolute biggest upset. They're playing really, really well. But South Melbourne's credit, I mean, they got the job done. They came away with the win. There was almost a moment at the end there for poor Alex Kondolian, the Moreland City goalkeeper. Josh, you posted the clip on your Twitter.
Yes.
Where he saved the ball, but he thought there was a foul, and he rolled it in front of him, but it was play on. And the South Melbourne player, Josh Wallen, just had a shot and he missed. And it was an absolute sitter. And it was almost
it was a replay of the Iñaki Williams chance against Portugal.
But it was like an even better chance from Wallen, because it was like he had a perfect run up. It was like him taking a penalty.
Because he runs to protest to the ref saying, what the hell? It's not a free kick. Yeah. And the ref goes, no, it's not a free kick. And he goes, oh, and then spins around and just rushes towards the loose ball.
Credit to Alex Kondolian. He had a fantastic game by that blemish, but it was a really good game. Moreland City showed they're going to be very competitive this year if they can keep that up. And South Melbourne doing South Melbourne things. But Josh, Friday night was a lot of fun, though. I know Preston lost. Great turnout for my first ever trip to BT Connor Reserve. I had a lot of fun joining you for that game, just quietly.
That was a good occasion. And there were 4,000 people at an NPL game, which I think is noteworthy. Like, that's... Like, it's quite impressive. I've obviously, my conflict of interest is considerable.
Multiple teams in the A-League are getting 4,000.
Yeah, but the ground was packed on all sides. You know, I saw some skepticism about the figure as well. If you, like, come down to a game and see for yourself. Like, it's packed. It is awesome. And, you know, the football on the pitch was sort of secondary to the occasion for the club and the fan experience.
Just as a novice, why are so many people turning up for Preston? Like, you know, no NPL club in the country gets these type of crowds. What's going on at Preston?
Well, firstly, Preston, in their sort of their kind of financial turmoil and relegations, always had really good crowds. Like, they before that, they had a really strong supporter base. They're probably the biggest, like, Macedonian cultural organization outside of Macedonia. Like, they're famous internationally. Like, you know, among the Macedonian community. So that it's still like a center of social life for people. Their interest did drop off radically when they went through their turmoil, and they went all the way down to State League 2. So that the club almost died. But I think part of the reason that you're seeing so many people come to these games is because the story of, like, that rise from the ashes, that Phoenix story, is so compelling to people, and these, like, successive promotions that they've had. And the excitement builds. I think they've also done a really good job with their, like, women and girls football at the club in recent years. And you see the demographic of the crowds is actually, like, quite strikingly female and skews young as well. So they've just done a good job of, like, engaging the community. And it's not just a Macedonian team anymore. It's, you know, it's a team for Reservoir and for Preston and for the North. So, there's a lot of things that the club does well, and there's a lot of things that the club, you know, is looking to, you know, always improve on. But I think the compelling narrative of a side, you know, that was in the doldrums and they nearly ceased to exist, coming back to its former glory, is just sort of an irresistible thing to be a part of. And then once it starts getting moving, it snowballs. So, you know, it's a question I've actually struggled with and tried to answer. And that's the best I can come up with, to be honest.
Yeah, well, I mean, other clubs around the country, especially with this second division coming, should look at them as a template to follow.
Alex in the comments says it's the kebabi. So, you know, there's that too.
You know, like just in terms of, as you said, Josh, I mean, it was amazing, like sort of just walking in there and feeling that buzz straight away. Like, I mean, the merchandise store at the front, as you sort of come through that new merchandise store and seeing, you know, reading on Facebook, was it three different food stalls throughout the venue as well? And, you know, you have to accommodate for that many people coming, and there were people packed behind the goals. Like, it was awesome seeing the crowd migrate from one side to the other as like Preston went to the right hand side instead of being the left in the first half. And it was a great game. And like, as much as it wasn't a win for Preston, there was a lot of, you know, excitement around the club and everything like that. But to bring it, I guess, to an A-League point of view as well with that, Norm Sekulowski, for those who know your A-League nostalgia, came on and played about how many minutes? That 70 minutes.
45. Wow. He came on a half time.
45. Came on a half time. But he came on early because Ryan Paczkowski got hurt a lot earlier. But I mean, he's like the heart and soul of the club, seeing him play, you know, and you know, still doing a decent job, you know, considering he's now what, 40 years old now, Josh?
He's just turned 40. And they've also got Sasha Ognanovsky, who's the kind of assistant coach. He's also the football director. And he's also registered in the squad. he won't play unless he needs to. But he's 42 or something. And he played a couple of games last year, Sasha Ognanovsky. Came out of retirement for the upteenth time.
So, and he still looks, you know, like he could do a role at an A-League club. Like, seeing him walk across the pitch, he looks ready to go. He doesn't.
And he still trains. He still trains with the senior men. He trains and coaches with the team while the head coach is coaching from the side when they're doing practice matches. And he just smashes people.
Jesus. Is he injuring his own players?
I mean, Sasha Ognanovsky does not hold back in training sessions. I think that's like the least surprising sentence that anyone's ever said, but it is striking to see.
Can I tell you a story quickly about just on that? One time, a very long time ago, Graham Souness was coaching at Rangers, and an Australian, a pretty famous Socceroo, or I won't say who it was because I don't know if I'm allowed to tell this story publicly, went on trial there. And he was kind of, you know, on trial there, and he was watching the training session. You'd never seen a guy who was like player coach. And Souness was in there at training, absolutely kicking the crap out of everyone. And this guy was 18 at the time. And he just thought to himself, there is no way I'm going out and training with this team. This guy is just going to see me and break my legs. And he said every single time he got the ball, just played first time. Wasn't even close to holding the ball at any point. You imagine like Graham Souness, your coach, is just like smashing players. Like, what's the point of that? Such a odd mentality. But
imagine like Gattuso's your coach and he's doing that.
So it's an Australian player that was 18 between the ages of years like, 1986 and 1991.
Go Google. Go enjoy your Google. You'll get there one day. Can I read out some comments, or Joey, you want to break some news?
Yeah, unfortunate news just coming through. Max Burford reporting for Channel 10 that Josh Cavallo, who has been playing some recent minutes as of late after recovering from injury and illness to start the season, ruptured his Achilles in the win in the 4-4 draw. So he's now going to have 9 months on the sideline, which is very unfortunate for him, given that he had just started playing again. And obviously, he just started playing again, and it's devastating for his football career, but it's also unfortunate given that this week is the Pride Cup game. He was going to come back and play in front of his friends and family here in Melbourne for the Pride Cup game, and now he's going to be on crutches for that. So that is even more unfortunate.
Well, from that bad news to potentially more bad news, Chris asked in the comments, A-League Fantasy has stole one around you.
I've checked this. You've won twice. You've won twice. Victory. But you've won twice, but you're still bottom of the league. Potentially bad news for you, Stoll. Do you know who's first?
No.
Phil Rollo is first in the league.
Man.
Phil has your Rollo.
All right. Well, our Liga asks nothing on Western United Wellington. Nope, go to Phil Rollo's podcast latest on Wellington.
Do we want to finish in 90 minutes or do we want to do anything?
No, we want to finish. No,
it's called the Ninth Place Podcast. It's a very good, very good time.
No. Very quickly, a lot of great comments coming through on YouTube. Just want to say also great comments coming in on Facebook. Shout out Wakas Wakas, this time for Africa. He says hello. He says, nice to meet you. And then he says, can I ask you? Can I ask you what, Wakas? Wakas, man. you leave us hanging. What a cliffhanger. Maybe next week we get finally a question from Wackus. But thank you so much, Wackus, for tuning in. And very quickly, a really good comment here. Joseph says, to add to Josh's points, this is on Preston Lions. I think it provides the best proper grassroots football atmosphere in Australia. Even my non-football watching girlfriend loved it. So there you go.
Awesome. And also, shout out to Terence Carter, who scored for Pasco Vale that day. Very, very handy player. Scored a nice goal at the start. Had a good game, Josh. But
yeah, extra motivation for him. It was one of those prove yourself to against your former club games. So it was an interesting storyline.
We've got 10 seconds. Plug away. Get your plugs in.
I got nothing.
See you next week. Thanks and success. Get in.